Welcome to the Book Club Haters Book Club,
a podcast where we discuss the books we love and otherwise. I'm Noor.
I'm Tia.
A very simple intro, Sita.
Yeah, and we didn't fight for it this time.
We're just both really tired of fighting for things, I guess, right now.
Oh, wow. Oh, are we? Okay, I didn't realize we're having this discussion while we're recording. Okay. Okay. How's reading for May or May?
May to June.
May to June, yeah.
I read...
May to mid-June.
I've read one book. It's the third book in a sci-fi romance series. Super fun, super kind of like you don't really need to think about it. And I guess that's the only thing that I can read at the moment.
Can you talk about the concept of sci-fi romance?
Well, sci-fi romance has a lot of the elements of sci-fi itself, where it's very out there and all the tech is weird, all the society is very advanced, quote unquote, but also not, but also recessive, which is, I think, a very something that's very particular to sci-fi, where it's very futuristic, but also the society is kind of very all the places, like the systemic issues within our society now is still available, is still in that society, in that futuristic society, or made even worse. So
like iPhones.
I don't know, actually. They don't have phones. They weirdly, this one does not have phones. They send messages through like satellites. I don't know.
Okay.
Which is
so,
what we do, don't we? I don't know. But anyway, good job. But the romance is like, it has like romance novel beats to it. Like they meet, they fight, they fall in love, they kiss in the end, everything ends up happily.
So you seem to be more knowledgeable in the romance part and not the sci-fi part.
Yeah, obviously.
Right. No, so does that mean like the writer, what do they prioritize in that combination?
This one, usually they strive for anything that's like a subgenre within romance, like romantic suspense or maybe like paranormal or sci-fi. Romance, they try to strike a balance between the two things. But for this one, I think the book is called Chaos Reigning, which is the third book in the Consortium Rebellion series by Jesse Mihalik. And I think she focuses more on the sci-fi part, and then she interweaves the couple's journey throughout the story.
I guess it isn't any different than any, I guess, YA book where the genre is like dystopia or utopia, but there's always elements of romance in them.
Yeah, in how they like how the story unfolds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always hate that about YA, that I just don't understand why romance have to exist in all books.
It sells. It's money.
But I still don't like it.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. I mean, I don't like how that's a selling point, this whole concept of... Like, I was thinking about The Hunger Games and how that book is about society and capitalism. It's a critique of capitalism, but people came out of it going Team PETA or Team, what's his other phrase? I don't know, Liam Hemsworth character.
Is that not the what? The oh gosh, I just thought bread. I don't know.
Yeah, that's PETA.
Okay.
He's the bread maker.
He's the bread person.
Yeah.
Don't know because, the other like, person. Well, obviously, yeah. Like, that's how they market it, right? Because romance is the biggest selling genre.
Yeah, I guess so. But at the same,
they want similarly slice of that pie.
A slice of that bread. Similarly, it's also the readers who are upping this narrative of Team Pita and Team What's His Face. I don't remember his other name. I'm really sorry. So macam the reader doesn't really, I don't know, should reader have the responsibility to, I don't know. I just don't like it, is what I'm saying. Even with like the book that we're reading for the book club, City of Brass, I was a bit like, why should this romance exist? Because I feel like it shouldn't exist, but we'll talk about that later.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm still reading because internet.
Oh, right.
Because life.
So I actually
finished it.
I finished it. It was my first audiobook that I finished. And congrats. I can tell you now, I'm not sure what I think about audiobooks. Yeah.
Why
the book
is
itself
that?
Is very interesting. So I okay, we'll talk about the audiobooks first and then we'll talk about the book. I'm not sure if I retain any information from the book. The only reason there's some stuff that I remember is because I was discussing it with somebody else because he happened to be reading the book too. So we just spent like a day or two talking about what the contents were. So at that time, like, it was really fresh in my mind what the contents were. Yeah. But because I listen to the book basically when I wake up in the morning and I get ready and stuff like that. And I can't remember most of them because I'm also doing other things. Sometimes it's just there as background noise. But yeah, so for me, reading nonfiction, sometimes I do kind of retain information quite well, but listening to it, I wasn't quite sure. I don't think the narration is bad. I think she's a really good narrator. And also she has this, the way she's reading her book has this kind of like, I imagine her grinning while she's reading the
book. Yeah, yeah. Right? I find that quite enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah, because I feel like when she's reading, when she's going through it, it sounds as if she can't believe that she's doing an audiobook.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I do like that. But yeah, like if you ask me, if there's how much stuff I remember from it, I don't think I remember much.
Yeah, same. I think that's my issue with audiobooks as well, because like last time when I listened to Gia Tolentino's Trick Mirror, I listened to the whole thing, but I can't remember like what exactly was being said, like the exact things. I remember like very vaguely. Like I don't even know the titles to things. It's just you know, just like random. It's like listening to your friend and you're like trying to recall, but it's like a very inaccurate.
Yeah.
A very inaccurate recall.
Because I think, right, with audiobooks, it's such a one-way street. And for me anyway, I realized when I was going through Because Internet, I had no time for reflection to what she was saying.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah, so we're a second, like I did another audiobook recently and I'm going to talk in a bit. And this time I had more time to reflect because I was conscious of what was happening the first time. But I think also part of the problem is that you don't know where certain narration ends and start because it just keeps going.
Yeah.
And so sometimes things just intertwine together that it just jumbles up.
Yeah, yeah. You're not sure like what exactly they're talking about.
Yeah.
Which part they're talking about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the book as a whole, I do quite enjoy it. Have you ever met anyone who's a paragraph texter?
Yes.
Have you?
Yeah, from work. And I quite enjoy it because I'm like, wow, this is nice. But also sometimes like, but I think it's very rare to meet those people.
Okay. For those, like, let me just describe paragraph texter. Paragraph texter, they text everything in one paragraph, including the questions they want to ask you. So they just, it's basically like reading a massive chunk of information on one text message. So they'll ask you, like, they'll answer your questions at the top and then they'll ask you questions at the bottom. So it's For me, it's very strange, and I've met a lot of those people since I moved to Australia.
Oh. Is it a culture thing? I don't know.
That's many. Weird. No. So the guy I was talking to about this, like about because internet a few weeks ago, he is a paragraph texter, whereas I am someone who texts sentences and just keeps sending it off. And that was one thing we were discussing about, because turns out, according to because internet, if you're a paragraph texter, it probably meant that you grew up without having a lot of expose to internet culture, or just you just don't grow up with a lot of with computers around you. So one of my friend, Gemma, she is a paragraph texter. The first time I met her, and she's the first ever paragraph texter I've ever met, and I was adapting to her because I thought, you know, because I've always been an adapter kind of person, so I adapted to her. And then I was talking to her recently about this after reading the book, and she's like, I didn't realize you're a sentence texter. And I was like, yeah, because I adapted to you. And then I asked her if she grew up with a lot of computers or internet when she was younger, and she said no. So it was really interesting, because like, I've met so many of these people who are paragraph texters, and I'm not.
And girl, we modern. Well, no, we just grew up with like a lot of shit, I guess.
Yeah, but also like for some people, they're sentence texters because in IRC before this, that's like a chat service or something online where you meet your friends and chat with them. If you type big chunks and press enter, you're probably going to get kicked out of the room, the chat room. By automatic.
What year was this?
I think I was using IRC, oh God, in 2001 or something. But I think there are a lot of people who have used it for far longer than I did. I didn't use it. I only used it like for a year. So you'll get kicked out. Whereas like if you write in sentences or it's just like smaller paragraphs, like maybe two sentences, you won't get kicked out. So that's part of that culture.
Oh gosh. Hold on. That was like a crash outside.
Oh no, that's fine. That's a Brunei household. There's households everywhere.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So this dude I was talking to who is a paragraph texter, and we're discussing like, what is your impression towards people who are sentence texter and then paragraph texter? And he said sentence texter, like me, seems very aloof, very informal. He thinks it comes off as rude, but he said that's my problem, that I don't think these people are rude necessarily. And whereas I think paragraph texters are very formal and very... they're probably less likely to text you more regularly in a day.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, because it's like... for me,
if I think of like someone who texts like a huge chunk of text, I'm just going to be like, okay, I guess this isn't going to be like the only one that I will see for today, I guess, if I think about it, yeah.
So like Gemma is a paragraph texter, and then she was telling me, oh, I only text people at the end of the day because that's the only time, because it's a lot of things to process in one whole paragraph. Because like sometimes there are like multiple questions at the bottom, like how was your day, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Whereas sentence texter, like I can text you throughout the day and be like one question and then you answer and then like I'll get back to it another time and then like one question and etc.
Yeah. It's very reminiscent to those times when it's like... writing letters at the end of the day, like replying to things.
Yeah, that's what paragraph texters are. So, because like I never understand people who are like, oh, I was really tired to answer your text messages, because I never really feel like that regularly anyway. Because sometimes it's just one question, right? And then I answer and then I don't have to deal with that person for the rest of the day. Whereas like whenever I have to deal with paragraph texter, I just get so exhausted because it's just so many things to type at one go and also so many things to ask at one go if you're trying to make a connection with these people.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I don't see a lot of paragraph... I actually have never seen paragraph texters in Brunei at all.
Yeah, the person that I was saying like at work, they didn't grow up in Brunei, so maybe that affects it.
Right. It's a cultural thing. It's like you kind of internalize it, but with the people that you talk to.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I always find it very interesting that, for me anyway, I see more sentence texters than paragraph texters, that there are people who just, I wouldn't say resist, they just don't acclimate themselves into being sentence texters. Yeah. So that's the thing that stood out to me the most. Yeah.
Yeah. I particularly, you know, I think I'm still at the part where I, last time, I think, mm-hmm. where it was, she was talking about lol or something, or the period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was kind of really interesting because I used to like put a period at the end of my texts. And
all of them?
When, yeah, most of my texts mm-hmm. to people. And then when I started dating my ex, he was like, every time I put a period, like if say we're like having a discussion like this through text and I put like a period at the end of my sentence, mm-hmm. he would think that I was annoyed or pissed or like angry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm just mm-hmm. like, it's just how sentences work. Like that's where you stop and take a breath,
right? That's funny. Your line of thought is really funny.
Yeah, that's how I think of it. But since he right. said that, I think it was like 3-4 years ago or something, I've just dropped off the period from my text now, just in case other people think the same.
Oh no, there are several instances when I see you send me a text with a period at the end and I'm like, okay, that's the end of that discussion.
Okay.
But that was like maybe last year or 2 years ago, but I haven't seen you doing that in a while.
Exactly, girl. Oh my God. Like,
yeah.
Oh gosh. I guess I'm acclimating myself to you guys, to you non-period users.
But that's really, I don't know, that's so bizarre. Like, I guess if you're trying to be very pedantic about this, you are right. But at the same time, most of the internet says that you're wrong.
Yeah, because like if you put a period to it, I didn't know, like, because like at that time I was mm-hmm. you know, Twitter wasn't at that point where like we had all these rules for memes. Uh-huh. And you know, like lowercase if you're like joking, or like
yeah,
if you're like no period, or you're like really weird, or punctuation. But
yeah
and I guess it was like still kind of on the rise of these rules, like what makes mm-hmm. a text informal and formal. So I think I'm still a little behind on it.
I don't think you are. No, I don't know. I don't know exactly. But the thing is, like, people online are going to pick the weirdest things in the way in how you type anyhow.
That's true.
Because, like, the last guy I was dating, I was showing him a picture of another person who was talking to me. And then they had capitalized the word Tinder, but not the first letter of his sentence. And then he just went off. Like, the dude I was dating just started going off about, why did he capitalize the word Tinder but not the first letter of his sentence? Like, that's such a weird thing. Like, is he a sociopath? I'm like, I don't understand why this is a big deal at all. Because for me, like, I don't notice that anymore. But I guess that's because when I'm talking to people, I'm slightly more freewheeling. Like, I don't care about my own punctuation, or I don't care about my own spelling.
Oh, for real. I probably have like a master's degree at this point with like PS typos. Like, I'm a master decipherer. Like, you can just go to me.
Yeah. Like, I think like a few days ago I was talking to you while I was eating and I just didn't care about the typo.
Yeah, I was like, okay. I think you said like SWK and I was like, Sarawak, okay.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Oh, did I? Oh shit. Okay. Yeah, so that's what I mean when I say I'm more freewheeling when I'm texting people. And I don't stress about it at all, even though it confuses people sometimes.
Yeah. I've had to get used to it. I'm used to it now.
Yeah, but like my personality is not that as freewheeling as the way I text. I guess for me, like, Whenever I get a text message, I usually just send them. I usually reply to them immediately, unless I really, really don't want to. There are very rare instances where I just don't want to. Yeah. Apparently, this is anxiety management.
Okay.
because someone texts you. Because for me, it's just like, oh, I want to get this out of the way right now. That way, it's. Because I swear, if I leave it, I will forget about it. Because I am someone who will be tempted to read a text message immediately and deal with it immediately, rather than, like, if it's a heavy topic, I'll probably leave it and then I'll forget about it, which is super rude. So usually I just tell people, like, can you text me again in, like, 3 hours? Because I'm not going to remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm not the opposite, but I think I used to be like that, and then mm-hmm. I just can't be bothered. So I'm just like, I'm going to take things at my own damn time. Fuck everything else. You're going to...
But that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
For me, answering text messages is not a difficult thing to do. For me, it's like, it's probably the easiest thing I can do for that day anyway. So I'll just answer it immediately. Yeah. So it's not a big deal for me. But I guess for a lot of people, it's like... I don't know. Gotta think
it through. Gotta think of that capitalization for my first letter of my sentence. Which I do, by the way. I capitalize the first letter of my sentences, except when I'm typing on WhatsApp web, on the computer. And the first time I used that with my boyfriend, he was like, why are you typing? What? This is so weird. Why aren't you capitalizing your first letter? Like, this is not you. And I was like,
that's
really?
Such a weird thing. That's such a weird thing to pick on. I just don't understand why people pick on that, because I wouldn't pick on it. I'll pick on how people, the language they use, but I wouldn't pick on what their punctuations and stuff are.
Yeah. I guess because he was thinking of how I usually text. And it's different. I bet you wouldn't.
Yeah, I would. Freewheeling texter looking at everyone's text going, oh, they're also freewheeling. Okay, so I want to talk about the book that I'm reading.
Yeah.
That I finished reading on audiobook.
Cool.
So I read Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, which is something that I've been wanting to read for a really long time now. It also, strangely, it was cheaper on audiobook than it was on not audiobook.
Huh.
On book form. Yeah, by $15.
Whoa, that's a lot of difference.
Yeah, it was very weird. So I like this book because, first of all, I think he's, as a narrator, he's a very strong narrator. Have you seen his shows before?
You showed me.
Did I?
No, wait, no. I have seen it. Not. You didn't show me. I've seen it. Yeah, I've seen some.
That's not something I would do.
Yeah, no. You showed me another nature show. A nature show. I don't remember whose it was.
Nature show?
Yeah.
Oh, I think I made you watch David Attenborough.
That's it. Yep.
Okay. So, this whole concept of the hard-ass chef and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of see it with, what's his face, the British guy.
Oh gosh, there's so many British guys.
Never mind. The one who's always angry all the time, but he's really nice to kids.
Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, Gordon Ramsay. So apparently this culture is very prevalent in, I guess, the kitchens in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying throughout the whole book to demystify this hard-ass chef concept. So... because he was saying in the kitchen, everything's really black and white because you're under time constraint and also under resources constraint. But outside the kitchen, he can be a very sentimental and empathetic person. So he said that sympathy during serving time doesn't work, but sympathy outside of working hours is probably better if you're trying to get something from him or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's the same if you're cooking with your family too, for big events. And what I find really interesting about him is that he has internalized this idea of, if you're going to be a chef, you have to be a hard ass and stuff like that. Mm. And over time, as he worked for a period of maybe 20, 30 years, he like a lot of these people are very complicated people. You start gaining sympathy, you start trying to be more empathetic. And I think as when he started doing his TV shows, you can kind of see this more empathetic person as opposed to like this very, I don't know, like iron fist chef kind of person. And he always comes off as like somebody who is not that fun to be with because he's just swearing all the time. And he's tall and he's big personality and he's sweary and he gets shouty sometimes. But I do like it because he was trying to unlearn a lot of things about food over the years. And this book was written in, it was published in 2000. And a lot of things I feel like has dated, which is the thing we're going to talk about later. But I want to talk about this, like tips on eating out. Mm-hmm. So what's important is when you're going to a restaurant, you should ask them when they get their fresh produce delivery.
Okay.
Yeah, because sometimes if you go to like restaurants and there's a special, the special probably means that they're trying to clear out their stock. And if it's fish, it probably means the fish has been there for a week.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which I thought was, okay, never order fish.
Never order the special ever again.
Yeah, never order special. Like, I think if it's root vegetables and stuff, probably okay. If it's in a soup, it's fine. Yeah. But if it's, like, fish, you shouldn't be eating fish that's over maybe 3 days old anyway.
Yeah.
Avoid places with large menus because it means that the food are not always fresh, and it doesn't mean that it will be good because the chef or the cook has not practiced cooking most of the food in the list. So like there are a lot of restaurants in Brunei that does this where they have pages and pages and pages of
I hate one of them.
Do you want to shame?
Yeah, I just said it. Why?
Right, yeah, YY does not have good food at all.
No.
Yeah, so because they have so many things. But the thing is, people go there for their dim sum, and their dim sum, I guess you, if it's popular, then it's fine. You can probably eat it. But if you're going to eat something else, then it's probably best to avoid it. But also he said that some of the stuff in the menu might have been in the freezer for a very long time already.
Oh, that's true, actually, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, if they have big menus, fine. Go eat stuff they're popular for, but try not to order out of it.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense.
And he said avoid cheap sushi because it means the... avoid cheap sushi if it doesn't fit with the price. Because it probably means the fish has been there for quite a while now. They're just trying to clear up fish. Yeah.
What about that? Where do you guys go? I feel like you've talked about this with Raul about like the cheap sushi days, like $2 sushi or something.
Oh right, the sushi te. I think I wouldn't go there. I have never gone there for cheap sushi. I've gone there with Iman before on multiple occasions whenever she really wants cheap sushi. But I don't think I ordered the sushi, honestly. I go there to eat cooked food because the sushi I find is not that great anyway. And like after my first experience, I just didn't eat sushi there because the salmon did feel a bit limbic. Yeah. So you can kind of taste it. Like if I go to... I wouldn't eat sushi at Escapade, but only because there have been multiple, like I have a very sensitive stomach and I have on multiple occasions have been sick from eating sushi at Escapade. But now that I think about it, it might also be because I've been eating the California roll, which has avocados, and I'm severely allergic to avocados.
Okay. So you can't really tell now.
But I think it might actually be the sushi because there's been several times when I just eat the sashimi and I still feel sick.
Okay. That's awesome.
Sick as in I couldn't get out of bed for 2 days, kind of sick.
Lord.
Yeah. So I think with the audiobook, this one, he has a very strong narrative. And after the first experience with Because Internet and listening to the audiobook, I had time to sit down and actually reflect what he's saying. And this is also one of those books where I don't know where things started and where it ended, because it just kept going and he talks quite fast. Mm. But when I arrive,
you can adjust that, right?
I know, but it's like, when does the chapter end? I mean, when does the chapter start? That's what I mean. Because sometimes like chapter titles are just like three words sometimes and you just miss it.
I hate when they don't say chapter something.
Chapter one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I see.
Instead, they just say the title of the chapter and I'm just like, oh, that was a title? Was it a subheading? I was like, come on, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't do that. He doesn't do like chapter one, chapter two. So that's why it was slightly confusing. But there are several occasions when I caught and I knew that it was a different chapter. But with this one, whenever I arrive at my destinations, because I listen to parts of it in a book, in the car, when I'm driving, mm-hmm. I do kind of switch on my engine and have a think about what he's been saying.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then I'll move on to my day.
Interesting.
I think maybe doing audiobooks easier to concentrate when I'm in the bathroom, when I'm trying to get ready.
Oh, too. Okay.
That's I don't know specific. What it is.
That's fine.
I think maybe it's the echo. Ah. Echo probably. Who knows? Yeah.
I find audiobooks like most enlightening, or like I can focus more on my drive because that's when I switch off my brain.
That's dangerous though.
Yeah. Not really. I don't know. It's okay. I don't really like, it's like I don't have to focus too much because like it's a regular commute. So it's fine.
Yeah,
I think
I
that's why I don't go to like, if I'm going to a new place, I don't turn on my audiobook.
Oh yeah, for sure. I do that too, I guess.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to move on to our new section?
Yes, the section that I don't remember the title of.
Okay, so we have a new section because we feel like we've exhausted genre talk. We have a section called Book Thoughts now.
Yes.
That's what we agreed on a day ago.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I want to talk about how things not aging well in books. Mm-hmm. Is it okay if I start?
Yeah.
So, okay, going back to the whole Kitchen Confidential thing. And this ties in with the current issue with the Bon Appetit magazine.
What is the current issue at Bon Appetit?
We'll talk about that in a bit, but let me talk about vegetarianism and veganism first. So mm-hmm. Bourdain said that one of the things that he and a lot of chefs apparently hate is people who demand for who request for vegetarian or vegan menus or vegetarian and vegan options. And he was very insistent about eating meat. Ooh. And again, this book was published in 2000. And I remember in 2000 how people hated people who are just vegetarian, not even vegan. Like right now, people hate vegans, but they don't hate vegetarians. So he was saying that vegetarians, like he was saying a lot of nasty things about vegetarians, basically. And I was thinking about how just listening to that, I myself am vegetarian right now. And I was thinking about how that, I feel, hasn't really aged that well. I kind of understand people who are frustrated with vegans, but I don't understand people who are frustrated with vegetarians because it's so easy to make vegetarian options now. Mm. And but also he didn't really specify, I think he probably did, maybe I didn't really pick up on it. Like he didn't really specify why he hates people who have asked for requests for vegetarians and vegan. Because nowadays, whenever you're talking about vegetarians and vegans and like a lot of people are actually making the switch because of environmental reasons.
Yeah.
And I find that very interesting because he was so hard pressed against vegetarians and vegans. Whereas nowadays, whenever I go to a restaurant or whenever I go to a cafe, there's always going to be vegetarian and vegan options, at least in Australia. Not the same case in Brunei anyway. And I was like, that that whole, because he went on and on and on about how much he hates vegetarians. And this is just vegetarians, okay? Not even vegans, which is even harder. Mm. And I thought, like, that hasn't really aged that well. Because I think a lot of chefs now are more accommodating to people who have not just requests for vegan or vegetarian options, but also like gluten-free, for instance, who wants to go like keto meal, which is not vegetarian or vegan. So it's so interesting to see how now, I guess, a lot of chefs are trying to adapt to people with allergens because, you know, our body can't take it. Yeah, you're right. But yeah, but I thought that was really interesting because listening to it, I thought, okay, he's super anti it, but this doesn't hold up anymore.
Yeah, like, because what is his, like...
It just doesn't.
What was his stance in the years after that book was published, right?
It does make me wonder. I mean, he passed away, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what his position is anymore before he passed. But I thought that was really interesting how... That part hasn't really aged well. And like another part that I feel like hasn't really aged well is that a lot of the chefs that he mentioned in the book are men. And there are several occasions. Yeah, it is a bit like, ugh. There are several occasions where he mentioned women and he'll just start talking about how much he loves women and stuff like that. Like, oh, I admire women in the kitchen and stuff like that. And like, I've always hated the whole concept of chefs anyway, because why do chefs have to be differentiated than cooks? Because cooks are usually women, chefs are usually men. Mm. And then he was talking about race and class and how he kept saying stuff like, without the French, for instance, we don't know what food actually is. But also, he acknowledged ethnic food throughout the book. Like, he talked about Mexican food and Japanese food. And I think what's interesting about Bourdain is that he's exposing this mindset of so many chefs in America, in that they trust high-class food culture. And they associate that food culture to French or Italian cuisines. Because, like... Hell, very few of them even acknowledge that Spanish food is probably superior because Spanish food has more flavor. It's Oof. Always like Italian or French,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, like Spanish food is so good, but no one ever actually says, all right, Spanish restaurant, like super fancy Spanish restaurant. It's always like French restaurants, which makes no sense to me. And like, it's interesting to me because like, again, this book was published in 2000, and that culture is still very prevalent now in light of like the whole Bon Appetit thing, because what has happened is that the past week they've exposed Bon Appetit has not been paying their black and people of color writers and editors.
Right? That was kind of wild videos. To me.
It's insane. And I didn't realize, because I honestly thought like, oh, you show up in video and you get paid. Like, and... Whereas, like, people like Sola, who is amazing, by the way. He's, like, my favorite person. Yeah, she is so good and she's so funny. Yeah, and she's always done, like, really amazing jobs. And she never gets paid for every time she appeared on a video. I didn't realize that they get paid to appear on the videos. And then, like, that is crazy to me that she... Because, like, one thing... Lately, okay, even before this whole thing was happening, I started to dislike Claire a bit.
Oh, me too, actually, because I think I disliked her why. From the Thanksgiving one, when she was with Christina, and she was just really just, oh gosh, girl.
Very controlling.
Yeah, very controlling.
Yeah. So like, she doesn't give way for other people to do what they want sometimes, and I find that really frustrating. Like, if I was to be in the same kitchen as her, I wouldn't want to be. I'd be like, well, I'm gonna fuck off from here because I don't feel like I'm being heard. And Claire gets paid like $20,000 per video, which is nuts to me.
Yeah.
And like, because like, also throughout the book, Bourdain was saying, oh, he's helping people who are Mexican, Ecuadorian, who's from Salvador or whatever. And he kept saying stuff like that. Oh, they can afford houses now. And I was like, is this a way for him to tame down his white guilt that these people who are working for him, who are cooking for him, who are line cooks, are never going to be the same status as of a chef as he is, he was. And it's kind of the same with like the whole Bon Appetit thing. Like, oh, you're right, you put as much people of color, you don't pay them the way they deserve to be paid.
Bonar, I was just like really shocked about all of it, actually. Oh, I don't think it's picking up, actually. No.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's continue.
Anyway, do you just want to apologize to the listeners they hear the sound?
I'm sorry if you guys hear that. I'm sure you will. There is some metal works going on in my backyard for a reason that I am not privy to. So.
Okay. Boo. Okay, anyway, what were we talking about?
People of color. Yeah, his line cooks being able to like afford, but like
afford houses and stuff. Yeah. So he was saying, Macham, I've given them a livelihood. So at the same time, I was thinking, this is just you just taming your white guilt, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't like it when people are like that, or like, I think in Brunei you see that often too, where there are bosses who are like, oh, I've given these people a good life, like a job that can enable them to do these things. But I'm just like, dude, like,
yeah, that there's a difference in you've given people good lives. That's not up to you to determine whether a person actually have a good life.
Yeah.
That's not up to you. Like, if you really want to give them a good life, pay for their medical bills, pay for their alleviate their anxiety, give them like mental health access or mental health,
give them fucking paid leave,
treatment access, stuff like that. Like, you can't, don't just tame your guilt by your superior race guilt by saying that, oh, I've given these people lives. You can say, I've given these people livelihoods. That's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Because it means you've given them money for their service. But yeah, I mean, like, we're all part of this capitalistic system. It's a shitty system. I'm so angry at it.
Yeah, I think like lately, it's been very, very, it's been extra apparent how shitty this system is, and I'm just I don't even know what to say. It's just, it's a lot.
I feel like I've been frustrated by it for a very long time, and I look at a lot of my friends, they're only frustrated by it now. Like, I haven't been making noise with the whole Black Lives Matter thing because we've been here before. Like, I remember protesting in London for Ferguson for the first time when Black Lives Matter started. And like, I'm like, this is the same thing. This was just 5 years ago. And when is it actually going to stop? But I think like this time around, it does seem way more, not aggressive, I feel it has like more, way more intense. Traction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's a discussion people are putting into their daily lives. And I really like the whole statues being, what is it, like
drown in a lake?
Not just being drowned, like they've been like people have been putting red paint on the hands of the statues, a lot of statues, like slave owner statues, which I really, really like that. It really appeals to the slightly anarchist in me. But yeah, like, it's just, this race discussion is going to keep going. And this doesn't just apply to white people. I guess it applies to like people who are of majority everywhere. There's a lot of confrontation that needs to be made. Just because things from like 10 years ago doesn't, oh, it was okay 10 years ago, doesn't mean it was okay. It was actually okay then. It's just that now is a time for confrontation. And like, reading Kitchen Confidential to me was like confronting white guilt. Because there are a lot of things that he would say, like the way he was talking about the woman, they're not like, he wasn't talking to them in a bad way. He was talking to them like, all right, this cook, this woman cook. And then he'll just dedicate a whole paragraph, but he'll dedicate like chapters and chapters to a lot of his male colleagues. And that was very jarring to me, because it just kind of goes to show that women are still not... an option people will go for in kitchens, which is really weird because they do a majority of the women do a lot of the cooking in households.
Yeah, yeah, that's always been a thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else to say about this? Because we're pretty far in.
I think we're fine. I think we should like move on and we can talk about sure. the other thing in the next episode.
Sure. We'll move on to question time.
Aha! Aha!
So, hello, welcome to question time. Like 15 minutes ago, we were like, I have no question for you. It's still the case for me now.
It is the same for me.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, let's see.
Do you, how about we make an agreement for this week, since we're both so tired, we don't have to ask questions relating to books?
Oh gosh, that's even harder for me.
That is not harder. I have a question for you.
Okay, hit me.
Do you iron your bed sheets?
I do not. I don't know any Bruneian who does.
My mom.
Oh my god, your mom family does. Extra.
I do.
Why?
My family, or my whole family, like my family always does, but to be fair, like most of the work is done by the woman. I don't know if the men would do it, but so I told somebody this recently and they're like, psychopath. Because I usually don't, I don't iron my bed sheets until quite recently, and they feel so much better ironed.
Do they?
Yeah, because there are no creases and stuff. But I guess it also depends on your laundry machine, if it, like, how much creasing it'll put on the sheets.
Right. Do you,
mine?
Yeah. What's yours?
Mine would crease the crap out of my bed sheets.
Oh, it depends also on the material of your bed sheets, right?
Yeah, because my blanket. I don't know. What is it called? What's the big?
Duvet.
What's the adult name? My duvet. My duvet cover is linen.
Oh yeah, that creases easily.
Yeah, but also my bed sheet is just cotton, and that also creases really aggressively. And I don't know if it has anything to do with just how you're drying it or whatever. So I started ironing my bed sheets a few months ago, and I really like it.
Okay, I don't know how you have like the patience. I don't. For me, I don't iron anything until like I have to. Absolutely right. Have to, like, iron things in the morning before work for my one baju kraja, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
I really like doing laundry.
I guess so.
Yeah, I do. I really like ironing. Yesterday I was supposed to go out for lunch with my friends, and but I was like, oh, I think I'd rather be ironing.
Oh gosh. Is that how you know you're did. Like an adult?
I've always really liked doing laundry. Even as a child.
That's a career alternative for you if the current one doesn't work out.
Hey, listen, I'm not saying I'm good at it. I'm not. But I really
doesn't matter.
Okay. Do you have a question?
Sure. I have a decorating question.
Oh, okay.
What's your like preferred type of like room? Do you prefer like a really dark and moody one, or like do you prefer like those light and airy white spaces?
Right. So my current apartment is my ideal apartment.
Sun-drenched.
I really like sun-drenched spaces, even though it gets really hot in the morning, even during the winter. So I like sun-drenched places, and I really like color, but the thing is that my landlord doesn't have a lot of color in the living room, so I just left it as it is. It's a very beige living room, but I quite like it because there's a lot of sun that comes in. I think dark rooms are a bit, I don't know how I feel about it. My bedroom is, like, during the night, I don't switch on all the lights. I only switch on one light because it really does give the mood that I'm ready to go to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's yours?
I think right now I'm, like, very into, I used to be into the the light and airy room, like sun-drenched and everything. I think I prefer that for like living rooms and like for wherever I'm like curling up with a book. But if it's like my bedroom, I want it to be like a cave. Like the most cave feeling ever. I want it cold, I want it dark, and I want not a single ray of sun, or like not a single light source. Basically darkness. So that's my thing lately.
Is it where you're talking about blinds? You're trying to buy blinds, right?
I'm saving up for blackout curtains, and they're a bit more expensive.
How much are they?
I have absolutely no idea. But my last one was like a super cheap material, which is like plastic PVC. That was $80 for two panels. I think I need like an extra long panel because my windows here are quite wide. So that's going to add up to the cost.
I think, is that a good idea? I don't know if I'd like... I have those blinds here, but they're not long enough. So sometimes in the morning, lights do seep through, but not too aggressively. So it still feels a bit.
A gentle glow. Like,
yeah, something like that. So it's
I don't want gentle glows. Nice.
Oh,
I am a bitch, vampire. Okay, then.
I wonder if in 10 years time, you're going to change your mind and be like, right, I want sun. Yeah,
maybe. Because like I used to really like waking up to like a very sun drenched room because my room faces east, so the sun rises, I can see it. And I used to really like that, but now I'm just like, no, my eyes they burn.
Right. Oh, but I also like having good views looking out the windows because like in Brunei, my bedroom just overlook a small hill, so I can't really see anything.
And you can see the house next door.
kind of like if I go really close. So I really didn't like that. And my room in Brunei was just very, very dark. So the lights have to constantly be on. And I don't like having lights on in the morning because I think it's a waste of electricity.
Same.
So I really like it here. Like the good thing about Australia is it's sunny all year round anyway. So I can just like open the many windows in the apartment and it's going to be light and I don't need to have the lights on, which I quite like.
Me too.
I never, like in the morning, I'm never in the bedroom. That's a thing I have to discipline myself.
Why is that?
Bedroom is for sleeping.
Oh, right, so right, okay.
Yeah, it's a way for me to like know that the comfort of the bed is only to be enjoyed at night.
Okay, I think that's too disciplined for me. I love my bed. So.
Right. No, I'm not saying I don't love my bed. I do. So I have to find like other places to do shit.
You have to appreciate it more.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, that's our question time.
That's
what the
question
fuck?
Question time.
Yeah. So let's move on to our book club.
Woo! So welcome to our book club. This month of June, we are reading, or we have read, The City of Brass.
May.
June. May? June.
Sorry.
Oh, God.
Sorry. Always.
We're reading The City of Brass June. By S.A. Chakraborty, the first book in the Devabad trilogy.
Yeah.
What do we think about it?
I love it. 5 stars. Okay, let's end this.
So good.
How many times have you read this book?
I think this is like my third.
I think it's like my third or my fourth. I don't remember.
It's really good. I'm so happy you recommended this to me.
What I like about this book is that no matter how many times I've read it, I don't remember most of it because it's such a long book. There's a lot of things to process. And whenever things happen, I'm like, no.
Yeah. I'm always like surprisingly... I'm surprised that I'm surprised. Always. Like,
yeah.
My third read, and I'm like, oh my God. And I'm nervous for her, nervous for him, and like, oh my God, this is so scary. Or like, okay, it's super nice.
So let's describe the book. So City of Brass is about a girl called Nari who lives in Cairo in the 18th century. And then out of nowhere, she accidentally summoned a jinn or slash deva called Dara. And then Dara decided to kidnap her and send her to to Devabad, which is a city of jinns. The reason why Dara decided to kidnap her is because she has shown abilities to heal, which is an ability that the people that Dara used to serve many centuries ago could do, and then apparently their lineage has depleted. So they went to Devabad, and then there's Ali, one of the many loves of my life.
Same. My boy.
I don't know how to describe it as we go into Devabad, like, and then we follow the life of Ali Zayed.
King. It's less like we follow Nari and then we follow Ali. It's kind of like we follow both of them, like
Serenta. Oh, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ali is also one of the main characters. English,
I totally forgot the word.
At the same time. What? Okay, anyway. What do we talk about? There's so many things to talk about.
So, like, Ali, let's just explain the characters first. So,
yes.
Nari is the healer, our protagonist. Mm-hmm. Dara is a summoned jinn / deva, who used mm-hmm. to be a slave, basically.
Slave.
Not even basically. It is said in the text that he is a slave. He was a slave.
Yes.
So he was enslaved to grant human wishes for many, 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 many years. And then there's Ali, Prince Ali Zayd, who is the second prince.
The love of my life.
Yeah, love him.
Okay.
Yeah, he's like 18. Yeah. Oh, wait, should we do ages? Nari is 20, about 20. Dara is ancient. Yeah. Ali
Dara is centuries old. I think like he might be 1400 old or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But he did now. Anyway, Ali is 18. 18, right? Yeah.
I think he's 18, yeah.
Then there's Muntadir, who is the crown prince.
The love of our lives.
The love of our lives. I love him. You love him. Everybody loves him. Legitimately, everybody loves him. Yeah. He's like a decade older than Ali, so about 28, I guess.
Yeah, but Muntadir is not a main character. He's just a side character that we really, really love.
Yeah, I love him. I love Muntadir. We love Muntadir. Majel. Yeah.
We do. Like,
we have every time, so many times as our like book boyfriend. That's it.
He is the book boyfriend. Every time I read this book, I message you and me like, I love Muntadir, and then like you message me the same a few days afterwards.
It's just so good.
I feel like I just want to talk about Muntadir and not anyone else.
It's really hard. But we have to talk about everyone else.
Okay, but we have to talk about Muntadir. Okay.
Yes, of course.
Let's talk about
So next one is Ghassan al-Qahtani, who is Muntadir and Alize's
dad,
who is also the king, like the jinn king. Yeah. He has the Suleiman's seal, mm-hmm. or eye, both things, which can seal, which can take away all magic. Wild shit.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Wild shit, yeah. You're wild shit, man. Anyway.
So those are our characters. So we follow Nari mm-hmm. and Ali Zayd. So we follow Nari on her journey towards Devabad for the first half of the book. And we follow Ali as he kind of comes to terms with the fact that he has unknowingly, sort of unknowingly, funded a terrorist organization.
Yeah. Who's your favorite character other than Muntadir?
Other than Nari? Also? I love Muntadir, Ali, and Nari, basically our main characters. I actually really like Ghassan for his character, not his like personality. Fuck yes. Ghassan, but also
no, you're right. Yeah,
yeah. As a character, he's great.
Like, I think you're right because like before this, I felt like I looked at Ghassan in a very one-dimensional view. But like rereading this, I was like, that is one manipulative motherfucker. He's so smart. And
especially as you like read the second book and you're like, what the fuck, this guy?
Yeah, actually, bitch, I don't remember anything from the second one, so I'll have to reread it again soon anyhow. But like with Ghassan, what I think is interesting is that a lot of characters of kings or of dictators, they're usually very one-dimensional and just, oh, he's evil, and that's it. But with him, you can kind of see the struggle that he has to go through to maintain peace in the city, which also means having to imprison people who have human blood, jinn and human blood, the Shafits. And because he's like, if I don't control them, I can't control the whole city. And then like, at the end, he had to exile Ali Zayd, which honestly, like the most heartbreaking chapter for me in the whole book, because you can kind of see that he had a really difficult time having to do that because Ali is obviously his favorite child.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I find him like a very pragmatic person who is kind of, I don't know, who he has to make hard choices for his role. And that's just, yeah, that's just the reality that it's just the responsibility that he takes on. And I think I find that kind of really admirable in some cases, because he's doing what he can. He might be like they might not be the best choices, but those are the choices that he feels are like justified. He doesn't do things just out of like cruelty, which I think like really differentiates him from everyone else, from every like other king and, like, character.
Yeah. So he's also risking his relationship with his son, which sucks. Yeah. Because Ali is fine. I really, really fucking love Ali, okay? Like, he is definitely my favorite character in the whole book. Like, I love Nari and Dara, I feel a bit meh about. But Ali, I really like that young person struggle of wanting equality, but still having to maintain cultural expectations. And sure, he is very, I think, like, his nature is just try to rescue people, but he also doesn't realize his privileges while he's doing it because he's still too young to realize those things.
Yeah. What struck me was like this one chapter where he's like being shown around by Kaveh, the Grand Wazir.
Yeah.
And he, like, Kaveh shows like very open hostility towards Ali. And Ali's like, why does he hate me so much? Does he really think that I'm going to kill everyone of his tribe? But throughout the first half, or like the first 3/4 of the book, he has been like constantly like saying derogatory things towards them. Like, he's like telling them in his mind, even, or like explicitly, that they are wrong, like fundamentally they are wrong. So he doesn't realize that what he's doing at the macam is just not that great. Basically, I think like this book is a very like all about like growing pains for everybody.
Yeah, for sure. But I also find what's interesting about what you're saying right now is that his prejudice is towards people of the high class and not towards people of the low class.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ali's motto is literally eat the rich.
Yeah, I love him for that though. Yeah, eat the rich, Ali. He's like, I don't need my family's money. But also
he doesn't.
Like, but he definitely benefits from it. And he just,
for sure,
doesn't, I don't know.
No, you're right. I think he's in a very difficult place because he grew up in the barracks. He didn't have those privileges. He is a prince, but he didn't grow up with those privileges for, I don't know how many years of his life. He was taken away when he was 5 or something, right?
Yeah.
So he didn't grow up with those. He grew up as a soldier, and suddenly he's given all these things, and he tried to refuse them many, many times. He's like, I want to go sleep at the citadel next to the people I grew up with. But the thing is, people like Muntadir and his sister Zainab keeps telling him, no, you have to sleep here. And you can kind of see that he was trying to deny those privileges by, instead of sleeping on the bed, he'll sleep on the floor.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, over time, as Nari comes into his life, because Nari asked him to teach her how to read, he start becoming more comfortable with the life of a prince.
Because, oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, after a while, he's like, okay, this is a thing I can do. But also, he was forced into that position because he was tasked to convince Nari to get married to Muntadir.
Yeah, to befriend Nari, so she would be more open to the marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. But Nari, though, the way she negotiates her wedding dowry, holy crap.
I love her.
Oh, what a woman.
Right? I wish, like, I had that kind of gumption.
Who are you trying... Whose dowry are you trying to negotiate?
My own dish?
Oh, no, I didn't know you're getting married.
To Muntadir, thanks.
Oh, right. Okay, I'll see. I see. So you want to talk about Dara?
Okay, so you and I have differing opinions on Dara.
Maybe, okay.
Maybe.
I can't remember what my last opinion was, but I think it's the same opinion. Okay.
Yeah. I don't hate him.
Okay.
I don't dislike him even. Like, I understand, like, I know, I dislike his actions towards Nari, towards, throughout the book, where everyone, he's trying to, like, control Nari's, like, future, like, what's best for her, whatever, mm-hmm. which is, like, very classic, like, dumbass, but, the best way that I can say it, but I don't dislike him, because mm-hmm. he is a ghost, like, I don't trust that he is himself. That's why I don't hate him, because I feel like he isn't a whole person. So why would I judge him with the same standards as a whole person like Nari and Ali? And
I would. Right. Okay. Interesting. I would judge him like shit.
Yeah. I know. Which I don't subscribe to that, I guess.
Hmm. Right. So for me, what I don't like about Dara is that he still holds these prejudices. And I know, like, prejudices take a long time to unlearn and stuff. But what I dislike is that he was also saying these things to Nari even when their friendship has developed.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, man, if a friend does that to me, that's really, really shitty. And, like, he avoids topics where that are crucial for Nari to know. And he didn't want to be associated with her when he sends her to Devabad. And he keeps making decisions on her behalf without telling her. Yes. And he only wants things his way. And he always thinks he's smarter than everyone, but he isn't. Like, despite the fact that Nari, on so many occasions, have shown that she's way more clever than him. And also, God, I lost my train of thought. The scene at the end... when
he kidnaps her.
Yeah, he kidnapped her, first of all. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And also, he kept thinking that he's much smarter than everyone else, but that's not really true, because he thinks just because he has age, he's under the impression that he has wisdom. And he kidnapped Nari and Ali and wanted to get off a boat, and he was under the impression that only he knows the boat was there. But the thing is that Ali was like, I'm sorry, actually, we know about the boat. We just haven't been able to bring it up the lake. Yeah. And people are always, other people, because they have the benefit of time of being there, are always one step ahead of him in so many ways. But he's always under the impression that, no, I'm the smart one. You cannot fool me. But the thing is, like, he's been on multiple occasions been fooled. And I really don't like that aspect of him, because it's like, man, you could be smarter.
Yeah, I think that's why he's like, he's very outdated. Like, his thinking ato macam very, you know, macam, he kind of reminds me of an old person, like, who thinks they know everything.
And he is.
And you know, just because he's hot doesn't, like, mean he's stupid. He's not stupid. So, but I still don't dislike him, because it's just, to me, I'm looking at, like, a ghost, essentially. And it just doesn't make sense to me to, like, think that this is actually him, you know? I understand that it is him.
So, it's so fascinating to hear you say these things, because sometimes you pass judgment on people so quickly. What you're yeah. saying right now sounds like something I would say, but I don't say that.
I think I have a lot more sympathy towards empathy or something towards mm-hmm. Fictional characters, because I can see what their backstory is and stuff.
Damn, girl.
Yeah, so that's a lot of internal reflection for me.
Apply that, yeah. Okay, you want to talk about Muntadir?
Muntadir, love of our lives. He is... What do we even say about Muntadir? He's like... I love how much he loves people.
He is such a fuckboy, though. First of all, Muntadir is like the biggest fuckboy because he goes to the harem. He sleeps with everyone, men, women, in between, jinns, devas, whatever. But at the same time, he is, I think, the most compassionate person in the whole book, which I don't fucking understand.
I agree. He I feel like he tries to find like a balance. He is more compassionate than Ghassan, I feel.
Yeah, for sure.
But he isn't weak.
No.
He isn't, like, naive like Ali is at this time. Yeah. And
He knows how to play his cards, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess that comes from himself and also, like, growing up in the palace mm-hmm. and being the crown prince and who has to be trained to be like that. But, like, the compassionate side of Tu is definitely him just being him.
Yeah, you don't really hear a lot of stories of crown princes... I listen to stories about crown princes or read stories about crown princes, it's always that they're spoiled. Yeah. But with Muntadir, he knows that he's spoiled, but at the same time, he's also very charming. He knows how to unite people together. Hell, he knows how to befriend Dara, which is like the most difficult person to befriend in the whole book. And he still cares for his family and he cares for his family's survival. And he's just so, oh God, I know. He's just so, such a lovely person despite all the flaws and all the, all his sins.
What sins? He does not sin.
That sounds like you're putting rose-tinted glasses all over him. He's like the most sinful person in the whole book. Homosexuality? Are you fucking kidding me?
Okay, so that's true. But I feel like Muntadir... Well, no, this is not an argument, but like I love Muntadir because he is so like... Jemana, I guess he just doesn't pass judgment towards people. And he does truly want the best for them. Mm-hmm. He tries.
Yeah. I mean, do you not think everyone else tries, though?
Yeah, they do. I just mm-hmm. have extra love for Muntadir, I guess.
Yeah, I don't really know. Like, other than, I think it's the whole compassionate thing. I feel like Muntadir should have been an easy character to hate.
But he is.
I have never read anyone saying that they dislike Muntadir. I feel like I don't read a lot of reviews of this book or anything like that, but I feel like every time I look at Chakraborty's Twitter and she talks about Muntadir, people just genuinely like him.
Yeah, why would anyone hate him? He's just
very
anyway.
Well loved. Because again, his character should have been easy to hate because, you know, like sinful, etc. Like you would think those kind of characters they're usually put in like a box. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but then, like
you're supposed to hate people who go to harems and stuff like that because it's not feminist to do stuff like that. It's not proper to do shit like that. But at the same time, like this dude though, he is sure he has all those things that he like and I guess shouldn't be allowed in society, but at the same time he's also super compassionate and I guess he pays the woman well. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the reason why it feels like he is a good person is despite the fact that he does those things is because we see a person Ali who doesn't do those things and we find him really problematic despite the fact that he doesn't sin. He thinks he doesn't sin. So, like, yeah.
Interesting argument. Did we like Ali in the second book? We did, right? No, Muntadir.
Yeah.
We did like him. Okay, cool.
Yeah,
he's just checking.
He maintains his greatness.
Yeah. The only thing I didn't like was that he spat on, at the end when he got married to Nari, which is what happened. He spat on her because he lost Ali. I guess it was his grieving process.
Yeah, that sucks.
That sucks.
I found this like that scene in like the what's it called, the harem place, where he was like drinking and like thinking that Ali was going to kill, was actually like thinking of killing him, and he was like so heartbroken. He thought that he was gonna get betrayed, and like
I wonder if that's it, because Muntadir is the only character that has shown heartache in the whole book, right?
Because
everyone else, like whenever they're disappointed, they do avoid processing it.
Yes.
Yeah, whereas Muntadir, he wore his heart on his sleeve whenever he feels certain things.
Yeah, oh, I think that's why. He knows how to express his feelings. I'm just like, I love him.
I was like, projecting.
No, but it's true. Like, don't you love people who, like, just understand their feelings? Like, who know how to communicate? It's a lot easier to deal with, I guess. Than, like...
I don't know.
Why don't you? Like, what's wrong with that?
On the occasions where I have shown my feelings, I have been rejected. I don't know. Maybe I should stop showing my feelings.
That's very all or nothing. For me, I don't know. That's not my motto.
Yeah, of course not. We are very different people from each other.
I also have something else, but I just lost it, so it's okay. I don't know. It'll come soon. But anyway, do you have anything?
I have to sit here for a minute to think about it?
No.
I love this book. I love it. But I think one thing that did annoy me about it, I wish there was more women character that Nari can talk to, because the only woman-to-woman interaction, not the only, like the most woman-to-woman interaction she had was with Nisrin, who is her teacher and teaching her how to heal and stuff. I wish she had
emotional support.
More interaction. Not just emotional support, but like, I guess, talking to other women, I guess.
That's true.
And we'll see that in the second book, I guess, with Zainab. But yeah, it's still a male-dominated narrative. Not narrative, like character-wise, it's just a lot more men.
Yeah.
But that's how it is with wars, I guess. I don't know.
Not true, but okay.
No, I mean, like, how people portray war is always men involved and never any woman, which sucks.
I like how this book is very YA style.
Is it YA, though?
No, it's not. It is very YA style. Like, the...
Okay, pacing. I'm looking at the genres.
What is it?
Right. I'm looking at the genres on Goodreads. It says fantasy, fiction, historical fiction, young adult.
Why is it young adult? I guess because Ali is a teen.
No, because she's a woman. The writer's a woman. That's why they put her as a young adult writer. Oh. They usually do that.
Okay.
I think we had this discussion last year.
Yeah, we did,
Yeah, they tend to do that, which sucks. They should not.
Yes, but it does pace like a young adult novel, which I quite like also.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of sci-fi books does not read this way. That's why for me it was far more palatable, because it's accessible to people who don't, whose English is not their first language. It's accessible in that the language is quite simple enough for you to understand, and the story is gripping enough for you to enjoy.
I actually found like there are so many big words in this book, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't notice. Okay.
So I was like, oh, God, do I got to look this up? And then I just couldn't be bothered. So I just moved on. So there are a lot of things that I probably missed out because I couldn't be bothered to look up the word So
that's okay.
Maybe one day I'll pick that's it up and fine. Pick up a dictionary next to me.
I guess the good thing is that you're reading on your phone though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, click on the word and then if you're connected to the internet, it'll show you the dictionary.
But for me, that kind of takes me out, you know? It takes me out of the flow.
Oh.
Not right. knowing, I'm okay. just like not knowing a word. It's just like, oh, great, I don't know what that means. But okay, skip. Like, I'll just imagine it as like something else.
Oh, right.
And it works, I guess.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Like, I usually, up until, yeah, until I mean, like before this. Before this read, I didn't know what a ziggurat was until right. I saw the word on like some random Twitter feed on my Twitter feed, and I was like, ah, so that's what it is. So all this time, I just did not know what okay. it looked like. Very blank.
Right, it's like that's the macam pyramid thing, but not the pyramid.
Yeah,
right?
A pyramid, but like it looks like it has like. That like a block on top of a block on top of a block.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There used to be a video game, I think, on for free or something on the computer, on PC, called the Ziggurat, mm-hmm. I think. It's been a while. Okay. Okay, is there anything else that you want to bring up?
No. But I am excited to watch, to read the next one.
I really am too. I'm genuinely excited, but I'm trying to read like other stuff too because I think I'm back to wanting to read right now.
Cool.
But we'll see if other things happen in my life in the next month. Ooh. But yeah, I'm super excited to read the second book. So our next book is King. What's the name? The Kingdom of Copper, the Devabhat Trilogy, number 2 by S.A. Chakraborty.
This is for July.
Who cares? Who cares what month it's for? I don't know.
Okay, great. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, please follow us on Twitter at Book Club Haters and follow our mothership at Songket Alliance on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr.
Ooh, okay, bye.
Bye.